You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And I saw the headline on the train on the way into work this morning, into the studios here in downtown Washington, D.C. And the headline in the New York Times, I was reading it on my phone, was Fort Hood gunman was being treated for depression. Now, there was a shooting, I believe it was yesterday. It was Wednesday. Yeah, yesterday. He killed three people. He wounded 16 others. And then he turned the gun on himself and killed himself. An Iraqi war veteran identified as Specialist Ivan Lopez. And it says in the article he had been treated, Specialist Lopez, end quote, David Montgomery, Manny Fernandez, and Timothy Williams were writing this to the New York Times. He had been prescribed Ambien, a sleep aid, and other medications to treat anxiety and depression, which immediately made me think of Dr. Peter Bregan. In fact, I called up Sean and said, you know, we got to talk to Dr. Bregan about this. Dr. Peter Bregan is a consulting psychiatrist, the author of numerous articles and books, including Medication Madness, The Role of Psychiatric Drugs in Cases of Violence, Suicide, and Crime. His most recent book is Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, a Guide for Prescribers, Therapists, Patients, and Families. His website is Bregan.com, B-R-E-G-G-I-N. Dr. Bregan, welcome back to the program.
Well, I'm really glad to be talking to you again. This is a tragic situation that is occurring to hundreds of thousands of soldiers. When you've got a man who probably has traumatic brain injury, he thought he did, TBI, and he's got post-traumatic stress disorder, and you put him on antidepressants, and the Washington Post actually says, Tom, that one of the commanders said that he was actually on antidepressants. That's in the Washington Post. Right. And you put him on antidepressants, and you've got a perfect storm for out-of-control behavior because the traumatic stress produces irritability, anger, difficulty controlling your emotions. Traumatic brain injury makes it harder for you to control your emotions. You can also get angry and irritable and feel upset and out of control. Antidepressants do exactly the same thing. They, for some people, and it's a significant number of people, they cause an irritability and anxiety and an anger that people they can't control and a loss of control. So you're creating a perfect storm in the lives of hundreds of thousands of our soldiers, some of them on active duty and fighting. And this is just not a surprising combination for me. I actually just published a book chapter in a legal military book about this perfect storm last month, and here it comes up now.
Wow. Now, we have a clip from one of the TV ads for one of these SSRI, the Selective Serotonin Reuptake Inhibitor families of antidepressant right. drugs, the ones that seem to be most closely associated with suicide, where somebody goes out in a blaze of glory and takes a bunch of people with them. Here's what they tell the public as they promote their product.
Is a prescription medication that treats many symptoms of depression. Tell your doctor right away if your depression worsens, you have unusual changes in behavior or thoughts of suicide. Antidepressants can increase these in children, teens, and young adults.
There you go. So, I mean, you know, from their own mouths.
Right, and not just the children and teens and young adults. That's what showed up in little tiny 4 and 6 week trials. We have tons of evidence that these drugs increase suicide and violence in adults, full grown older adults.
So, could you speak to this? We've had school shootings, we've had mall shootings, we've had a couple of military base shootings. In almost every case. In another generation, it might have just been suicide by cop or even just plain old suicide. But aren't most of these actually suicides?
Well, they're in part suicides. They're getting even. They're, you know, the person's feeling they're finally getting a chance to fight back or make a statement or prove themselves. But they all of these people have been through psychiatry. I mean, one of the keys here is the answer isn't more of my profession. I'm a psychiatrist. It's not more psychiatry. The Naval Yard shooter, he was on an antidepressant just a few weeks before the shooting, which is your big danger time. I think one of the reasons, Tom, we're not hearing anything about the Naval Yard shooter is because we have a direct correlation with his starting the antidepressants, flipping him out. Adam Lanza, the Connecticut shooter, they've never released his records, but I've seen a tape of the assistant attorney general of Connecticut saying, well, if we released his medication list, people would stop taking their drugs.
Right.
So there's a lot brewing here, and such control the drug companies have over not letting any of this be discussed in public.
Well, now that the drug companies can legally sell their products on national network television, they have become a multi-million, certainly, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars, maybe billions, who knows, of dollar cash cow for the same media networks that are bringing us infotainment that they call news. And the last time we talked, you said that you were trying to compile information to find out, you know, what actual percentage of the people who were these mass shooters were on these, particularly the SSRI drugs, but on antidepressant drugs, and whether this correlation, whether this was these were outliers or whether there was, you know, a causative correlation here. How has that gone?
Well, it's very hard to get the information. One of the things we know with certainty is almost every single one, whether you're looking at the college shooters or the Colorado shooter in the theater, they've all been through psychiatry. Most of them are in psychiatry. That means they're on drugs because my colleagues don't do anything but drugs. So I think we can assume that in all likelihood Adam Lanza was on drugs. We know the Naval Yard shooter was on drugs. We know this man was on the drugs. And we know that a number of other very significant cases, Columbine, that one of the young men was taking an antidepressant at the time of the shooting. So they're playing a role. There's absolutely no doubt they're playing
a role. Now, my understanding is that the mechanism is that these drugs decrease affect. They decrease the ability to experience emotion. And empathy is the emotion that we experience that causes us to recognize our fellow human beings as being human just like us. And if we can drop our emotional threshold to the point where we don't feel much empathy for others, then many of these people, when they're out shooting and killing people, at an emotional level, they're just playing a video game. Is that an accurate characterization of how these drugs work?
That's a really well-described description of part of what happens. That's active in a lot of the cases. In my practice, I see people come to me after 2 weeks on antidepressants, and they're already losing their feeling for the people around them. But these drugs also have very amphetamine-like effects, which is one reason why psychiatrists who know what they're doing or think they know what they're doing routinely put people on a sedative at the same time they put them on these drugs. Doesn't work very well either. But these drugs have amphetamine or cocaine-like effects. They cause insomnia. They cause agitation, anxiety, irritability, anger, hostility. And every word I've just used is actually in the label, including aggressiveness and hostility, is in the official FDA-approved label for these drugs.
And suicide.
So they actually drive violent behavior while they cut off your empathy. That's a prescription for disaster.
Yeah, absolutely. Dr. Peter Bregan, a practicing psychiatrist, the author of numerous articles and books, including Medication Madness, his most recent book, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, a guide for prescribers, therapists, patients, and families. His website, Bregan, BREGGIN.com. Dr. Bregan, great talking to you. Thank you for being
here.
Good
to talk.
And let's just keep this topic alive. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's that loss of affect, that loss of emotional connection that most freaks me out. More about that after. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. Nate Sweet, international television superstar and producer of The Big Picture, on the line with us. Hey, Nate.
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Very well, thank you. So we're going to start out with Mr. Papantonio tonight.
We got America's Lawyer on in the first segment for his weekly Thursday segment. We'll be talking about sort of a complicated issue, the role of, you know, corporates, not necessarily corporate surveillance, but corporate data collecting, its role in surveillance, and you know, whether or not we should be as afraid of that as big government surveillance and the intersection between those two. It's sort of a big topic, but it's definitely something people are becoming more aware of these days. You know, Google just asked the Supreme Court to legalize its practice of sucking up data from unencrypted Wi-Fi networks, as you know, Google collects information for its Google Maps program on the Street View aspect of that program, and they were collecting data from people's Wi-Fi networks. They've actually asked the Supreme Court to legalize that now. So that's going to be in there as well. Some interesting stuff with PAP. And then we'll get his thoughts on the McCutcheon ruling yesterday at the Supreme Court.
Yeah, pretty amazing. And in Block B, Ben Beachy is going to be with us from Public Citizens Global Trade Watch.
Yes, Ben Beachy's going to come on. He's going to give us the latest update on TPP negotiations, which ironically have something to do with NAFTA. Michael Froman, who's the trade representative, has been, I guess, in a way to shift people's opinion of TPP, has been talking about how great NAFTA was, and has been, Ben's going to talk about those, that his numbers don't really add up at all.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And CNN?
And then, Tommy Christopher, who's now at the Daily Banter, formerly of Media, he's going to come on. We'll be talking about the coverage of the IPCC report. What's interesting is there seems to be this pattern now of just the politicization of climate change coverage. It's really, only happens in the progressive media. And that's sort of a problem because you want to get out there to as many people as possible with as big of an issue as climate change.
Well, all of the networks, including MSNBC, are taking big bucks from the fossil fuel industry.
MSNBC actually did spend a lot of time on the IPCC report. It's better than nothing, but it's still, I would hope that it would be on every single network all the time.
Yeah, you would think.
And then C is your take, my take. In D, we got Derek Khanna coming on. He's going to talk about the sort of falling off the radar now, but the Tesla story out of New Jersey where the government essentially prevented Tesla from selling its cars directly from factory outlets. And then Daily Take is on also about cars. It's about the GM parts controversy, how they essentially just allowed this defective part to continue going to their cars and how that shows we need to bring back the corporate death penalty.
Right. Derek, I see, is he wrote the House Republican Study Committee memo on reforming copyright law. Do you know his take on the Tesla thing?
We'll get it from him as soon as we can. But I know in the past he's been in favor of pretty consumer-friendly legislation. He was pushing for the bill that unlocked cell phones, that bill that actually passed a few weeks ago. So generally he's on the side of consumer rights sort of stuff. Derek's an interesting guy, so definitely it'd be interesting to have that sort of bipartisan discussion here on the show.
That'll be fascinating. And Tommy Christopher has recently changed jobs.
Yeah, he's now at the Daily Banter. He's the White House correspondent for the Daily Banter, no longer with Mediaite.
Right, Ben Cohen's group.
Yep.
And is it thedailybanter.com or dailybanter.com?
I can one or the check other. You right now.
So, anyway.
Either way, it should be easy through a quick Google search for people to find.
Yeah, there you go. Okay. Nate Sweet, thanks a lot, Nate.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking with you. It's 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. You know, it's entirely reasonable and even quite appropriate, in my opinion. This is purely my opinion that I'm sharing with you. For somebody who is going through a short-term, and probably, exogenous, externally caused emotional crisis. For example, their spouse dies. Or for some people, it might be their pet dies. I mean, their marriage falls apart, or a long-term relationship, or they lose their job, or they're losing their home. The banksters have stolen their home. It's entirely appropriate, for such a person to feel really bad, really depressed, really upset, and sometimes even to think about suicide. I mean, that just happens. That's, the human part of the human condition. And it's also, I think, appropriate with great care for a physician or a psychiatrist to intervene with such a person using appropriate medication. I know that I can't say that as an absolute assertion, but I believe that Dr. Bregan would probably disagree with that and say there's almost no time when a medication would be appropriate, that if you have to sit there and hold their hand all day, do it. I'm sort of, a little, I don't see this as black and white. The thing that concerns me is that when you look at the double-blind placebo-controlled studies for these antidepressants, what you find is that the placebos are typically within a few points of being just as effective as the antidepressants themselves. One, in other words, you give somebody a pill and you tell them that it's going to work, and their brain will make it work. The placebo effect is absolutely astounding. It even extends to things like severe pain. So, number one, there's, in my mind, not a large body of truth that these drugs are all that effective. At least the kind, these very subtle drugs that take weeks to come on and alter serotonin chemistry in the brain. Now, I could see the more short-term acting drugs being used for something like this. Perhaps the benzo drugs. I realize people are freaked out about those things, you know, the old Valium and Xanax. But even there, I mean, there's such a potential for habituation and addiction, and withdrawal can be so severe from those things that if you've got somebody on them for more than a week, you're wandering into dangerous territory. So, but even those drugs don't dull affect as much as they just basically, you know, deal with anxiety. They're more anti-anxiety drugs than antidepressant drugs. And I don't think that there are any genuinely antidepressant drugs out there that don't have the potential to kill affect, to kill the ability to feel emotions. And, you know, when really awful things happen, it's entirely appropriate to feel emotions and even to be overwhelmed by those emotions. In fact, it might be an important part of the healing, and in many cases is. So while there may be some cases, and I would acknowledge that there may be some cases where it's appropriate to intervene pharmaceutically, I really and truly think they're far and few between. I think they're a single-digit percent of the number of people who are on these drugs. And the other big problem, particularly with the SSRI drugs, and this is one that we're going to see, just as we learned with the benzo drugs after the 70s, is that after a decade or so, people are stuck. I mean, back in the 60s and 70s, it was not uncommon for regular family docs to routinely prescribe Valium to mostly to housewives, actually. I know three different people whose mothers, back in the 70s when we were in our teens and 20s, whose mothers were on Valium. It was common. There was a book written about it, Valley of the Dolls. Is it Erica Jong wrote that? About women who were, you know, mixing up their drugs, and then they would, you know, get amphetamines to pick them up in the morning and benzos to calm them down at night and all this kind of thing. And, you know, it seemed fairly harmless for a while. And then after a year or two, people were like, hey, I'm addicted. If I stop taking this stuff, I start getting electric shocks in my brain and deep, deep depression. Well, I predict that, I think it's already happening now, but as time goes on, particularly because the SSRI drugs cause things like impotence and disconnect people from emotions and thus damage relationships, or don't allow relationships to be fully experienced, don't allow people to fully experience life in its horrors or in its joys, that people start to say, you know, I think I want to get off this drug. And then when they try to get off it, they find that it's like trying to quit smoking. I mean, it's really, really brutal, hard stuff to do. And the doctors are not facing up to this because, you know, it's a multi-billion-dollar industry. They make money writing the prescriptions. The pharmaceutical companies make a whole lot more money peddling the drugs. They're taking the doctors to conventions and training them. And there's a sense of everybody does it, so it must be okay. Just like back in the 60s and 70s, among doctors, there was a sense of, oh, yeah, everybody's prescribing Qualodes. Everybody's prescribing Valium. It must be okay. And it turns out it wasn't okay. They don't even make Qualids anymore because so many people went off the edge on them. The same thing with the barbiturate drugs, Seconal and butabarbital. And the Amitol, I don't remember the names of them. There's a bunch of them. But when I was 18 years old, there was a friend of mine who was depressed. And, you know, Clark and I found his body. I mean, he died from an overdose of barbiturates, which I'm pretty sure was unintentional. He was mixing barbiturates and alcohol on a Saturday afternoon. And it wasn't a massive dose that he had taken. I mean, most of the pill bottle was sitting right there next to him full. So we just, you know, so they don't prescribe those anymore.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
In fact, those, the barbiturates, those are the drugs that they're using for physician-assisted suicide now in Oregon and Washington State. I mean, dangerous stuff. So what are we going to know about these drugs, these SRIs, in 10 years? Breaking news, the Senate panel, headed up by Dianne Feinstein, the Senate panel on intelligence, has voted to release the report on the CIA's torture activities during the Bush administration, stuff that Obama put an end to the day he came into office. And, you know, Bush and Cheney are still running around going, oh, yeah, I would have done it again. And you know, but this not only gave America a black eye around the world, and encourage despots around the world to use torture. But because we haven't come to terms with it yet, we haven't cleaned it up, and we haven't prosecuted the perpetrator. I mean, we're talking about a situation. This is not some small thing. We're talking about a situation here where a number of people died at the hands of their torturers. Others will be scarred for life. Many of them are still sitting in Guantanamo. They're trying to kill themselves. And we're forcing them. We're putting tubes down their nose to put food into their stomachs to force them to stay alive. And some idiot in the Bush White House thought this was a good idea. Jay Bybee and John Yoo and Alberto Gonzalez and Condi Rice and Dick Cheney and George W. Bush and these frightened little men and women. I mean, you'd think that you could look back on the Salem witch trials or look back on the grand, you know, the Spanish Inquisition and get that torture doesn't work. I mean, just at a practical level, it doesn't work. But I think these are essentially brutal people who wanted to indulge their own brutality. And then the CIA knew that they'd done wrong. They destroyed hundreds of hours of videotape of these interrogations. They just destroyed the evidence. And has anybody been held accountable for that? Not to the best of my knowledge. So this is going to get very, very interesting, because when these guys decided that they were going to spy on Dianne Feinstein, she had been by and large their friend and facilitator, and she said, no, enough. And we'll see how this goes. Tom in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Tom, you wanted to talk about the psychotropic or psychoactive drugs. No, Tom. Okay, Dan in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Dan, thanks for listening to KABQ. Are you there?
This is Dan.
Yeah, okay, great.
Oh, okay.
Every now and then, yeah. I think, you know, Comcast has croaked our phones again.
No, so. This is Dan. I'm from California, but that's okay.
Oh, okay. It says Albuquerque. But
yeah, I just wanted to say I'm a pharmacist, I guess. I can say that.
Mm-hmm.
There are differences in the – it seems like the combined serotonin, norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors as a group tend to be more of a problem with suicide. So when you get the serotonin reuptake inhibitors, maybe a little bit less. And the tricyclics, the old antidepressants, sometimes work good for people that have a significant suicide risk.
Right.
The problem with this guy is we don't know how many times he was seeing the psychiatrist, or, you know, they were in the process of diagnosing the post-traumatic stress syndrome, and there's all these details which may never be released about the shooter. But the thing is that if you mentioned holding your hand. Yeah, in the first 6 to 8 weeks, sometimes it takes for the antidepressant to work. really closely following that patient with, I was going to say psychotherapy, but with the psych, talking with the psychologist, psychiatrist is critical. And of course, the teens and the younger patients are even more at risk. But
right. And the insurance companies don't pay for that. They pay for 15 minutes with a psychiatrist once every month, you know, or once every two weeks
at
the most.
Yeah, some plans are very bad, but hopefully that'll get better. But like the combined, like venlafaxine is a combined serotonin norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor, causes higher suicide risk than the old Prozac or fluoxetine drug that everybody was worried about.
Right, which was just an SSRI. And those are higher than the old tricyclics. Why not just...
And citalopram, too, is a sort of a derivative from another drug that is very much like it. You know, you start in low doses, and you follow these people closely, but you never, and a lot of physicians do this. I don't know if the psychiatrist is aware. He probably doesn't. But regular physicians will say, stop antidepressant. And so instead of gradually reducing the dose, when you stop an antidepressant suddenly, the chances of going into the same problems that we were talking about, the anxiety, the withdrawal symptoms that can cause kind of a, I don't want to say violence, but...
Well, it can cause violence. Let's be candid about it.
So
I mean, that's...
If you quit it suddenly and the guy becomes non-compliant, then you got the issue coming back of the depression, or if they're bipolar, which you can use some of these in, that can come back. So we don't know if this guy stopped his stuff or.
Yeah, I'm not trying to. I'm using the story of this fellow as a hook to bring up the topic, but I'm not personally speculating about him, and I don't think any of us can. It would be inappropriate too, other than that. The Washington Post and the New York Times are both reporting that he was on antidepressant drugs. We don't know which ones.
Right.
And thus, you know, the topic is engaged in my mind, and it's a conversation that I think we need to have. I'm just curious, as a pharmacist, what percentage of the patients that you see who are given prescriptions for SSRIs or norepinephrine, y'all have to say the word, I'm sorry, and SSRI inhibitors, what percentage of them continue on those for a year or more?
I would you counsel for them to be on those. I mean, we can't, you know, as a pharmacist, I can't say, okay.
Sure, I understand.
You know, stop.
I'm just wondering how widespread is long-term use of these things as opposed to the relatively short-term use, which is what they were originally developed for.
Yes, they originally developed, and there's so-called situational depression and things like that. And we don't always have the exact specific diagnosis. You know, in a lot of the software now, particularly in hospitals, you can get diagnoses, but they may just be major depressive disorder. And, you know, all that's in the patient's chart. So the psychiatrist has to say, okay, is this a short-term disorder because they lost a loved one or situational, or is this something by asking the questions, and that this guy does actually have a major depressive disorder or bipolar where one might fit.
But are you finding that a lot of people are on these things for a long time or not?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
That's what I was trying to get to. And that's the thing that concerns me, because that's, you know, the few people I know who have just come out and told me that they're on, you know, name the drug, you know, Paxil, Prozac, whatever. You say, you know, how long you've been on? Oh, 3 years, you know, 2 years, 5 years. And, you know, I know several people who are in that situation, and it's almost like it's become just the thing that they take every day that keeps them normal. And that seems to me like really scary, particularly if you're depending on health insurance to pay for it. And what happens if you lose your health insurance, or what happens if, you know,
then you're in trouble, and you got to, you know, the talk therapy.
Yeah.
Is a key, and both are key components. Of
And again, we have a problem with our insurance companies. Dan, thanks for the call. I want to get some other folks in here. We've got a whole board full of people who want to bring up this topic. Ann in Marietta, Georgia.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to talk also about the antidepressants, and you can't just lump everybody into a broad stroke. I've been on a very low dosage of one for a dozen years.
Mm-hmm.
And trust me, I can still cry and I can still experience a lot of joy. But this tiny little dosage is what makes me able to cope. So I think it's just different people. And I'm fortunate enough to have had a doctor who we experimented for a lot. Prozac made me a zombie.
Mm-hmm.
Zoloft made me a zombie. But what I'm on now is wonderful, and I hope I never have to stop it.
Yeah. Well, you know, all I can say is good on you, Ann. I mean, if you've found what works for you, and, you know, you're working it out with your physician, I would not, you know, come in on my high horse and say anything about that other than, you know, great. My concern is when these, you know, high doses of inappropriate medications are given without a lot of supervision, and we end up with school shooters.
And I totally agree with you. People committing suicide.
And these things are treated like they're panaceas, and they're not. They're pharmaceuticals. So, Ann, thank you for the call, and I wish you the very best. Victor in Pittsburgh, Missouri. Hey, Victor.
Yes, good afternoon, Tom. First of all, I wanted to share with you, I was a behavioral science specialist and a combat medic in the military.
Mm-hmm.
So I work with doctors, psychiatrists, and counseled many service members. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, I'm also a veteran
uh-huh.
and suffering from some delayed post-traumatic stress. And been on these medications and actually took myself off of Zoloft.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for me taking myself off of Zoloft was intentional. The purpose was it took away my feeling.
Yeah.
Totally away me from my feeling.
Yeah.
And so, I wanted to respond to that.
So you wanted to re-experience the world, and so you took yourself off the drugs. So is the net of your message that people need more counseling and fewer drugs?
Yes. My advice is this, and I find this to be true. In the VA, there's a shortage of counseling.
Yes.
And
well, in the general society at large, there is, and particularly in terms of availability because of the expense and the insurance problem. Victor, we're out of time. I'm sorry, but your point was very well made. Thank you for the call, and thanks for sharing your expertise with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So you think a bunch of the torturers over at the CIA, or maybe Jay Bybee and John Yoo, are trying to get prescriptions for antidepressants right now? Welcome back. Jim in Chillicothe, Illinois. Is that how it's said on watching Free Speech TV?
Yeah.
Hey, Jim.
I took those, I'm a 20-year lung cancer survivor.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Good on you.
And I took that back in the day when this first started because I was really depressed.
Mm-hmm.
And that stuff just wouldn't make me take a gun to my head every time.
Really?
So I just had to quit that. And they look at me like, why don't you want to take these?
Yeah.
No, I don't want to take those. I've fired so many doctors over the years that I've fired more than what I see.
Yeah.
And a lot of the post stuff that's happened to me has been caused by these doctors and dentists.
Yeah.
Dentistry is a big fraud.
That's interesting. We have a friend who had a persistent yeast infection of all things, and she went to her doctor, and he tried a couple of things, a couple of different drugs, didn't do any good, and so he said, "Well, let me prescribe Prozac for you." Like, you know, I can't treat your yeast infection, but I can treat your anxiety around it. And it's like, really, seriously, that's how you're going to treat a yeast infection? They have become so casual about these drugs. And these are really serious, powerful pharmaceuticals. So it's bad stuff. Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Mary, in watching Free Speech TV in Little Mountain, South Carolina, on the Dish Network. Hey, Mary, what's
up? Hi, Tom. I just wanted to comment on your Valium you were talking about earlier. In the early 70s, I'm 65, by the way. In the early 70s, I was having some problems. I was married to an alcoholic. My mother suggested I go to a psychiatrist. So I took her up on the suggestion, and I went. And at the time, they had a sliding scale for payment, and I was able to go for free. And I was amazed. I think it was after the first or second time I went to the psychiatrist, he prescribed me Valium, 100 tablets of Valium a month.
Whoa.
And what it made me basically was a walking zombie. And I had to stop because I just felt like I couldn't, you know, do normal things anymore.
Yeah.
And now, conversely or ironically, I'm 65 and now I have some kind of spinal stenosis. And I have a lot of pain just walking and everything. And my husband also, he has a crushed vertebrae in his back. And the doctors are actually afraid to prescribe pain medication to you.
Yeah.
And I'm made to feel like a criminal when I go to the pharmacist and everything, and they treat you like you're a criminal instead of
I went through this 6 months ago. If you watch me on TV, you saw that I had my arm in a sling for about 3 months. I had a frozen shoulder, my left shoulder, which is insanely painful. And I went to an orthopedic surgeon, and he would only give me 5 milligrams of codeine, and codeine is like, you know. I mean, it's cough syrup in Canada, you know, and then I went to my regular doc, and my blood pressure was like 190 over 150, and she said, this is because you're in pain, and she said, go back and get something stronger for the pain, and I went back to get something stronger for the pain, and he's like, I can't do that, you know, so I just, you know, for about 2 months was just living with insane amounts of pain every day, because I didn't want to go through the whole fire the doc, find another doc, make it look like I'm seeking narcotics, and you know, that'll follow you for years and years and years on your medical records. Thanks, Mary, for the call. Anyway, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you 10 minutes before the hour. Yeah, our system's all screwed up. Our system is just seriously all screwed up. Dana in Marcin, Idaho. Hey, Dana, what's up?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was going to tell you a story about my friend who he has to take a physical every year for his job, and so he has white coat syndrome. His blood pressure goes up every time he has to get his blood pressure taken. And
yeah, that used to happen. That happens
sorry?
To me. It happens to a lot of people. Their blood pressure goes up 5 to 10 points just from walking to the doctor's office.
Exactly. And his one doctor put him on some kind of antidepressant. And after taking it about a week and a half, he said he stopped taking it. He said it made him feel really weird. And he went back to his doctor, and his doctor was very upset with him and wanted to tell him to get back on him. And he fired his doctor, went to another doctor. And now they understand the white coat syndrome. And so they just let him relax, talk to him and get him his mind off of it and take his blood pressure a couple of times until he's normal.
Yeah, that's what my doc does now. It's when I go in for, you know, once or twice a year, and she takes my blood pressure, and then she'll, you know, say I'll be back in 10 minutes, and, you know, and she does it again before I leave. And it's always 5 or 10 points lower when the second time. I think that's a really, really common thing. Dana, thanks for calling and sharing that story. Martin in Chicago, listen to WCPT. You worked in behavioral and mental health?
I do. I work in behavioral and mental health and with adolescents and adults, and I myself am in recovery as well and have been in for quite some time. Thank you for having me on the show. I've noticed a lot of individuals, both young teens as well as adults, being misprescribed medication.
Mm-hmm.
And because there's such a vast array of pharmaceuticals at our disposal, and because of the amount of pharmacies that are available and doctors as well, there are a lot of teens coming out of rehab programs that are being placed on a lot of medication and are being mistreated. For example, somebody who may suffer from alcoholism may show signs of mood disorder, behavioral disorders, as well as attention deficit disorder, even violence, and would therefore be placed on antidepressants and mood stabilizers. And these drugs are really intense, and as well as like heavy loads of benzodiazepines. And I think the problem that we're running into is that there are a lot of doctors who in the 80s and 90s were really comfortable prescribing benzodiazepines and pain medication and mood stabilizers with a lot of leniency, mm-hmm. who now have got a lot more restrictions by the FDA and the DEA.
Right.
And so like another gentleman earlier mentioned, there's a lot of pressure coming from the pharmacies on the patients to not be taking the medication, but the doctors are over-prescribing people.
Yeah.
Like, I know for myself, I take Effexor. I've taken Prozac in the 80s in the boom where all the kids were over-prescribed medication, when everybody learned what everything was. And I eventually came off that, and I lived a happy, productive life for many years. And I wound up having horrible root canal surgery over and over again. And I was placed on opiates, and I developed a tolerance and then developed a dependence while in recovery. And as a result, I was going to the pharmacy all the time.
Right.
And, you know, when you have a relationship with a doctor, even an intimate relationship, once you're on a drug that changes your mental state, your relationship with that doctor changes. And they make different calls to protect themselves as well.
Sure.
But that changes the way that we operate in society.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so for me, I take a relatively high dose of Effexor, which basically for me, as I described it to some other people who were not comfortable taking the medication, who had experience with taking antidepressants before, is that for me, it basically takes all of the bad qualities of my life and sets them to the side and allows me to live a happy and productive lifestyle.
Well, I'm glad it's working for you. I wonder if we might, some people, not necessarily you, Martin, but some people might be depriving themselves of part of the experience of life by and the opportunity to work through things by not having those bad experiences. But if, you know, it sounds sort of like Soma, you know, everybody takes it and everybody's happy and life is groovy.
Yeah, it's really dangerous.
Yeah, and it could be. Martin, thank you for the call. Peter in Saratoga Springs, New York. Hey, Peter.
How you doing, Tom?
Good.
My story a little bit is that about 10 years ago, I was going through a divorce, and my doctor, I was struggling a little bit. I was seeing a psychologist, and my family doctor then prescribed me some Zoloft, and I have to admit that after about 3 to 4 weeks, I truly felt a difference, and it helped me work through that, very much so. The
Good.
Problem was that here it's 10 years later, and I was still on it.
Whoa.
And, well, you don't think of, I mean, you go to your doctor every week, and you, so finally, I, after some other health issues and getting healthy, I told them, let's start reducing this. Well, that creates a whole nother issue. SSRI withdrawal is unbelievable.
Yeah.
It is intense. And when I hear about these, you know, suicides, and I hear about these things, if you've ever been through that, I have to be honest, I can almost understand, you know, I'm fortunate I have a good support around me with my wife and everyone,
right.
But the withdrawal from those medications is very intense.
Well, and it's because the brain is so plastic, the brain actually grows new serotonin receptors because there's, you know, or grows fewer serotonin, one or the other, but, you know, because the SSRIs are reducing the uptake, the reuptake of serotonin, and thus the destruction of serotonin. So they're increasing the amount of serotonin in the brain. So the brain becomes less sensitive to serotonin. And you drop the drugs, and now you don't have that flood of serotonin, and you need it. It's one of the chemicals that's necessary for the brain to work. And, you know, it's like driving your car when you run out of gas.
Never went through. So what we did was, obviously, is I had to slow down the reduction.
Right.
You have to really get that to a point where it's manageable and slowly, and ultimately then you get off. But very dangerous in getting off. People need to be careful.
Yeah, I agree. Peter, thank you for the call, and thanks for sharing your story with us. We'll be back. It's coming up on the top of the hour. Barbara Honegger is going to be with us. We're going to talk about what we were discussing yesterday.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer. maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And on the line with us is Barbara Honegger, former Reagan State Department staff member, author of a brilliant book called The October Surprise, about the way that the Reagan campaign won the election, as it were, of 1980, something that now former president of Iran, Bonnie Sauter, has basically said the same thing. Barbara, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Tom. Just so your listeners know, I was with the White House and Justice Department as opposed to State.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
The White House, and in fact, in the back of your book is a picture of you standing between President Reagan and Vice President Bush.
That's correct.
You heard our program yesterday where Phyllis Schlafly was on, and she was talking about, basically her opposition to workplace protections for women with regard to wages. And I understand this was actually the issue that provoked you to leave the Reagan White House. Do I have that right?
Well, yes and no. I mean, that is just one of the general reason that I left the White House was actually because for the first time in recent American history, both the Democrat and Republican Party, up until Ronald Reagan's campaign for president in 1980, had supported the Equal Rights Amendment. And in the campaign, in order to pander to the American Taliban Christian fundamentalist base, they, for the first time, withdrew their support for the Equal Rights Amendment. And I was in the campaign at that time, and I was, as soon as Reagan won, and we went into the transition, and I was in the West Wing of the White House, I was working for the chief domestic policy advisor to Reagan, Dr. Martin Anderson, in the West Wing, and I was appointed to head the so-called ERA alternative, and I resigned on late August of 1983 after I learned in high-level council meetings in the White House and the Justice Department that the Reagan Justice Department was planning a secret attack on all of the civil rights statutes, including the Civil Rights Act of 1964, using the strategy of the weak link in the chain that we did not have an Equal Rights Amendment. And I exposed the perfidy of this secret plan in the longest fact-based opinion piece ever published. It was an entire page in the Washington Post on or around August 23 of 1983.
Wow.
And that resulted in about 10 days of international publicity.
Right.
So I actually resigned over the attack on all of women's rights and all of civil rights, and of course, equal pay for equal work and equal worth in the marketplace is a special case of that.
Right. And your pushback to Phyllis Schlafly's, she's not here to defend herself, so let's not personalize it to her. To those people who would say that we already have plenty of protections for women. The EEOC is full of bureaucrats who are looking for opportunities to defend women in the workplace, and there's no need for any more legislation.
Well, that's, of course, ridiculous. It's completely ridiculous. Under Republican administrations, especially after on and after the Reagan administration, the administration, Republican administrations, do everything they can not to enforce those laws through the EEOC. And the horrible thing is that, as I understand it, if it's still the case as it was then, women are forced to go through the EEOC and so-called exhaust internal remedies in this ridiculously long process that often doesn't pan out and usually doesn't pan out, and then they're able to go to court if they have the wherewithal, and, of course, they don't, because they're discriminated against in terms of wages and salaries and promotion and all of that in the marketplace to begin with.
Remarkable. Remarkable. So good. I wanted to get that on the record from somebody who was there and who knows what was going on. And the conservatives are still up to their old tricks, and they're still pushing this stuff, and they're still pushing back against the Democrats promoting the idea of equality in the workplace. Can I change the subject to the October surprise for a moment?
Oh, would you mind? There are 2 points I'd like to make about
Please
my
do.
Experience with women's rights, if I could briefly.
Please do.
Okay. I would just like people to understand the degree of perfidy of the Republican Party, starting with the Reagan administration. And this is a personal experience I had. I was head of the so-called Equal Rights Amendment Alternative in the Justice Department, and spent over a year and a half identifying every single instance of gender discrimination against girls and women in the entire code of U.S. federal law, and all of the Code of Federal Regulations and all policy practices and procedures of all then 46 federal agencies. And that resulted in 7 volumes published by the government printing office. It stands about a foot and a half high. And to this day, they are still not corrected, Tom. And I took those 7 volumes after they were printed in late summer of 1983. I had an appointment with Jim Baker, who is White House Chief of Staff to Reagan. And in that meeting, he had those volumes for about 2 weeks. Then he called me in. And just the two of us in his office, he put his hand on top of that stack of laws that still discriminate against girls and women in this country. And he looked in my eyes and he said, with his Texas drawl, he said, "Barbara, I can't imagine any advocate for American girls and women better than you. But I just want to go on the record here that equal rights for women is no longer anything that this administration and the Republican Party wants to expend any financial or political capital on," unquote.
Wow.
And he said, "Would you like to take these books? I have no use for them." And
wow.
I took them in my arms, and I walked straight out of the White House and down to the Washington Post into Meg Greenfield's office. And after that, it's history. So the perfidy is really unbelievable. And the other experience that I had that the American people need to understand is that the day that the ratification deadline ran out on the Equal Rights Amendment, because the states had a certain period of time in order to ratify, the day that the Equal Rights Amendment died, there was a huge celebratory dinner and dance in a fancy Washington, D.C. hotel, and because I worked in the West Wing of the White House with the domestic policy advisor on the issue of women's rights, I was invited. And at that dinner, Phyllis Schlafly was at the dais on the stage, and the entire event was thanking her and celebrating with her for the defeat of the Equal Rights Amendment. And at the moment, the penultimate moment, the band played Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead, the witch being Equal Rights for American Women.
Hmm.
And it was as if someone had put a knife into my stomach. I just want the American people to know how bad the Republican Party is, and that the war on women started consciously against American women, and it is still going on today, and it started with the Reagan administration.
Barbara, we just have a minute left. Do you think that war on women is the result of, you know, reaching out to misogynists, or is there some economic or political motive behind it? Why?
Well, it's both. It's both. The real reason is that there are the Republican men, and I know this from talking to them and having them being honest with me in the White House and the Justice Department, they're scared to death that, quote, their women, if you recall George W. Bush talked about our women, they're afraid to death that their wives especially are going to get out of control. And, of course, that's the whole point. Women should not be under the control of any other human being any more than a man should be. And the reality is that For decades and decades and centuries and millennia, the institution, the so-called traditional institution of marriage, has been effectively biological slavery. It's also economic slavery for the father, but it is literally biological slavery for the woman. And it's really no different. There will be a time in our history in the future when the traditional marriage will be seen as fundamentally no different than slavery.
I don't disagree at all. Hang on just a second, Barbara.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Barbara Honegger, formerly with the Reagan administration, and the author of October Surprise. Thank you, Barbara.
You're welcome.
Please hold on for just a second. I take some phone calls here for a few minutes, and I want to see if we can get Barbara back on to talk about the October Surprise stuff. I don't know if she's available for it. But Vicki in Mondovi, Wisconsin. Hey, Vicki, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network. What's up?
Boy, Barbara Honegger really opened my eyes. Anyway,
she's good.
I need to tell you regarding prescription drugs for depression. After my second nervous breakdown, it was determined that I suffer from clinical depression,
mm-hmm.
and that was over 20 years ago. And I've been on a series of antidepressants since then, trying to find the right one that would work, and I finally have. And I need to say that without them, I would not be here now.
Mm-hmm. So you're a pharmaceutical success story. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a long time, but I truly feel like I'm one of the people that they have helped. And I realize they're overprescribed just because doctors find it easy to do that.
Right. Well, and that was my point apropos of this Navy Yard, or not Navy Yard shooter, the Fort Hood gunman. That, you know, he was on these drugs. We had Dr. Peter Bregan on in the last hour, and he said that virtually all of these shooters are on these SSRI drugs, and he's just opposed to all of them. And I'm saying, you know, for some people they're lifesavers. Apparently, you're one of them, Vicki. And for other people, they destroy their lives. And it's like we just need to be.
It's unconscionable that they just prescribe them without intent.
Yeah. But we need to be more careful about it. Vicki, thank you for the call. And thank you for watching Free Speech TV. Tanya in Colorado Springs, Colorado, watching us on the Dish Network. Hey, Tanya.
Hi there. As a child, I was on phenobarbital.
Did you have epilepsy?
Sure have.
Uh-huh.
Still have it. It's just I can control it. As an adult, I've been on Depakote. But what's really worked for me is just moving to Colorado.
Oh, really? Medical pot is working for you?
Absolutely, 100%. And also taking away certain legal drugs, such as taking the alcohol out of my life and the caffeine.
Right.
And learning how to go to bed early and at a consistent time. And I think that's what happens to a lot of people, especially if you're depressed, you stay awake and then you have the lights on and then it messes with your head. And years after years of not sleeping well,
right,
causes a lot of depression.
Yeah.
But just if you were to move to Colorado and self-medicate, a lot of your problems can be maybe dissipate.
You know, I have read so many stories now in the mainstream press about people who are moving to Colorado, in many cases because they have a child with seizure disorders, and apparently there's a variety of medical marijuana that's not as psychoactive, but it is high in cannabinoids, that actually mm-hmm. is very effective for seizure disorders, that people are actually moving to Colorado.
The children's seizures are seizing to exist, basically,
yeah,
as soon as the children are here within weeks.
Yeah.
And there's plenty of organizations that you can donate to get these children out to Colorado. You got to look on Facebook.
Wow.
I just totally encourage everybody to.
So there's actually an organized effort around this.
There sure is. But guess what? I live in Colorado Springs where medical marijuana, you have to have a license for it, so people cannot come to recreate. You
right.
cannot come to the southern Colorado to recreate. So if you think you're going to drive to Colorado to have some recreation, please check your maps and please check where you're going so you don't end up flying into a town and spending a lot of money to have to drive to Denver.
Okay. Tanya, thank you for that, and thanks for the information. We'll be right back. I believe it was about a decade ago. It might have even been a little longer. I was so flying someplace. I was walking through an airport bookstore, and there on the table of the books right by the checkout counter was a copy of Barbara Honegger's book, October Surprise. And I thought, oh, this looks interesting. And I picked it up, and I read it on the airplane, and it just totally blew my mind. And so I wanted to get Barbara back on to discuss that. Barbara, you're still with us?
I sure am, Tom.
Great. I want to play for you first something that was not available at the time you wrote this book. The Lyndon Johnson Library just a few years ago, I think it was 3 years ago, released a whole series of White House tapes and with very little fanfare. And to the best of my knowledge, the mainstream media didn't even pick up on this. I did. And I discovered that LBJ in the summer of 1968, this was the Nixon-Humphrey election, in the summer of 1968, he had actually negotiated peace between the South Vietnamese, North Vietnamese, and America, and was going to announce it in September, which would help Hubert Humphrey, of course, win the election. The Nixon campaign found out about it, and out of their New Mexico base, their operation, they sabotaged it by going to Madam Tu and saying, we'll not only give you a better deal, but we'll make you rich. And here's a 30-second clip of Lyndon Johnson talking with Everett Dirksen, the most powerful Republican in the United States Senate and probably one of the most high-integrity Republicans that this country has produced in my lifetime, talking about this. Here it is.
Here's the latest information we got. The agent says that they just talked to the boss in New Mexico.
Uh-huh.
And that he says that you must hold out. Just hold on until after the election. We know what Chu is saying to them out there.
Yeah.
We're pretty well informed on both ends. Now, I'm reading their hand, Everett. I don't want to get this in the campaign.
That's right.
And they oughtn't to be doing this. This is treason.
I know.
Everett Dirksen, I know. So Lyndon Johnson, so Hubert Humphrey lost the election to Richard Nixon because Richard Nixon committed treason by blowing up a peace deal. And then you document in your book, October Surprise, how something very similar that happened during the Reagan campaign against Jimmy Carter. And I want to come back and have you describe that. And then, of course, George W. Bush was selected by the Supreme Court. So I asked this question of Jimmy Carter day before yesterday on this program. You have that queued up? Here it is. About three or four years ago, the LBJ Library released tapes of LBJ working with Everett Dirksen trying to stop the Nixon campaign in 68 from blocking LBJ's peace deal with South Vietnam. They were not successful, and Dirksen called what Nixon did treason, and that those tapes are now available. President Bonnie Sauter has said that something similar happened to you during the Reagan campaign, and George W. Bush was only president because of the intervention of the U.S. Supreme Court, something you've commented on in the past. I'm wondering, you know, have we had a legitimately elected Republican president since Dwight Eisenhower?
Well, I think so. I wouldn't want to comment on that. That's pretty gross. But yeah, I think we've had a legitimate elected president. I don't think that George W. Bush won the election in 2000 against Al Gore, because I think he probably lost Florida and also that nationwide. But you know, when the Supreme Court rules in our country, that's what we have to accept.
So, Barbara, your thoughts on all of this and what happened in 1980?
Well, first, allow me to say that the treason by the Nixon administration to scuttle the peace deal of LBJ is actually in my book, in the early part of my book. And I make the point that the identical individual in both cases, Richard V. Allen, was one of the intermediaries, the major intermediaries in both treasons.
I'm going to have to go back and read your book. It's been 10 years.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, so that is in the book, yeah.
Okay.
But of course, I didn't have the tape, and the tape proves it, doesn't it?
Yes.
I would like to also say, President Carter's comment, my understanding, and you should check this, Tom, my understanding is that in case of a contested presidential election, that the Constitution is clear that the House of Representatives makes the decision, not the Supreme Court.
Yes, you're correct.
So, if that is correct, I think that President Carter is just incorrect in his statement that in that case, that the Supreme Court's decision should have ruled. Al Gore clearly won the election. We know that. There was a consortium of the New York Times, Washington Post media consortium, did a recount of the ballots in Florida. And unfortunately, that was after the attacks of 9/11. And so the news didn't get too much play at the time. But it was clear that in almost every, except for one exception, Al Gore won the Florida election and therefore the general election in 2000. So we did not have a legitimate president. I expected Jimmy Carter, President Carter, to say that his election was legitimate the first time, and of course it was. But in any case,
he was not a Republican. So.
No. But yeah. I think your question to him was, have we had a legitimate presidency?
No, I asked if there was a legitimately elected Republican president.
Oh, I didn't hear.
Since Dwight Eisenhower.
Okay. So I think your general question was, what do I think about the October surprise per se in 1980?
Yeah. We have about two minutes if you just want to fill in our listeners on what happened.
Yeah. Well, my book, The October Surprise, is called October Surprise. It's available on Amazon still. The bottom line is that the 1980 Reagan-Bush campaign, where I was at the very top, I had information from the inside of the campaign, which I detail in the early chapters of my book, that the Reagan-Bush campaign in 1980 had cut a secret deal with the radical fundamentalist Khomeini regime in Iran to delay the release of our 52 hostages who were then being held against their will in Tehran, some of them in even prison and throughout Iran. They'd been scattered by that time throughout Iran. And that the Republicans didn't want the hostages to come home to Carter.
Right.
Because Carter would have won the election.
Yep.
So we had done very detailed polling, and we had learned that if the hostages came home any time between the 18th of October and the 25th of October, 1980, that Carter would win and Reagan would lose. So on precisely the 18th of October, the 18th and 19th of October, top emissaries from the Reagan-Bush campaign, including then Vice Presidential candidate George H.W. Bush himself and William Casey, soon to be CIA director, did meet with the top Khomeini representatives to cut this treasonous deal, which was very similar to the deal that Richard B. Allen
It's absolutely remarkable. Absolutely wonderful. Barbara Honegger, October Surprise.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Barbara, if there's anything I can do to help you get this book back in print, give me a shot, okay?
Oh, thank you. Okay.
Good talking with you. Bye. Thank you for being on. We'll be back. Yep, it's the good, the bad, the very, very Linceanly ugly, brought to you by the Organic Wine Company, EcoWine.com. The good, Congressman Adam Schiff and Representative Walter Jones, the latter a Republican. The two congressmen have just introduced a bill in the House of Representatives that would require the Obama administration to release an annual report cataloging the number of people killed by American drone strikes. Their bill would also require the administration to publish a report chronicling the number of civilians killed in American drone strikes. According to Schiff, his bill is, quote, a way of holding ourselves accountable, as well as being transparent to the rest of the world about our drone program. In my opinion, we need to end the drone war altogether, but it's still good to see that two of our elected representatives can put party politics aside and work for what's right. Well done, Congressman Schiff and Congressman Jones. The bad, Phil Bryant. Mississippi's Republican governor will reportedly sign a bill passed on Tuesday by the Mississippi legislature that would essentially allow business owners to discriminate against LGBT customers in the name of religious liberty. The bill, which is called the Religious Freedom of Restoration Act by its supporters, is similar to the Religious Liberty Bill vetoed by Arizona Governor Jan Brewer last month. And if signed, it'll go into effect on July 1st. The ghost of Jim Crow, it seems, is alive and well in the Magnolia State. And the very, very ugly, Donald Rumsfeld. During an interview for Errol Morris's new documentary, The Unknown Known, the former defense secretary denied that he and other people in the Bush administration tried to make it seem like Saddam Hussein was connected with Al-Qaeda and the 9/11 attacks. Check it out.
People began to think that Saddam was connected with Al-Qaeda and with 9/11.
Oh, I don't think so. It was very clear that the direct planning for 9/11 was done by Osama bin Laden's people, Al-Qaeda, and in Afghanistan. I don't think the American people were confused about that.
In 2003, in a Washington Post poll, 69% said they believe it is likely the Iraqi leader was personally involved in the attacks carried out by Al-Qaeda.
I don't remember anyone in the Bush administration saying anything like that.
Right. No one in the Bush administration ever tried to make it seem like Saddam was connected to 9/11. Right.
Mr. Secretary, today in a broadcast interview, Saddam Hussein said, "There is only one truth. Iraq has no weapons of mass destruction whatsoever." And he went on to say, "I would like to tell you directly, we have no relationship with Al-Qaeda."
And Abraham Lincoln was short.
Right. 11 years and hundreds of thousands of lives later, Donald Rumsfeld is still lying to the American people and the world. That is very, very ugly. It's incredibly ugly. Okay. Steve in Michigan. Hey, Steve, what's up? You wanted to talk about prescription drugs?
Yeah, I'm on a couple of them. They're supposed to be, antidepressant drugs.
Mm-hmm.
But what they have me on for is headaches.
Hmm.
I was rear-ended in a car accident, and I have a couple of vertebrae in my neck and a couple in my back that are pinching nerves.
Ooh.
And
I'm assuming that you went through all the, you know, physical therapy or chiropractors or osteopaths or whatever, you know.
I've been through, I've got lower back issues and everything else also.
Yeah. So do the antidepressant drugs help with the pain, or does the pain cause anxiety that you need the antidepressant drugs for?
No, I think it's one of them is a neurotransmitter blocker,
mm-hmm.
and the other one is a neuroreceiver blocker.
Right.
So it stops the one nerve from making the connection, and it makes the other one stop from receiving the connection.
Interesting. Okay.
And I'm also on the Soma, and it doesn't make me all googly and whatnot.
On Soma? Soma was the name of the drug that Aldous Huxley invented in Brave New World.
Yeah, well, I use it for sleeping and for muscle spasms.
Oh, okay. That it must be something with a very similar name. Or maybe somebody actually came out with a drug.
It might be the generic name for it. Yeah. I don't know, but that's what's on my pillow.
Okay. Well, that's very interesting. Steve, but you're not having the negative side effects, and you don't feel like going out and shooting up a school. That's your point, right?
No. Yeah. I mean, to be honest with you, the Tea Partier people make me a little bit more upset than anything else.
Yeah, okay. Well, unfortunately, there's not a pharmaceutical remedy for that. Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Julia in Toronto, Canada. Hey, Julia, you had a bad experience with SSRIs?
Yeah, I did. I was 15 years old when I was prescribed Paxil.
Mm-hmm. That's a young age to get a serious drug like that at.
Yeah. I was diagnosed with childhood depression.
Mm-hmm.
And actually what happened was I started taking Paxil, and the first day I started taking it, I started feeling like really weird sensations. Like when I would yawn, like the yawn would like just etch throughout my body.
Hmm.
And I started having like really weird thoughts and insomnia. And then I started thinking that the girl who I was sharing a room with was going to kill me. And I, after a few days of taking it, I went into like a full psychosis.
Whoa.
And I ended up in the psychiatric ward of a hospital for about a month.
Whoa. And they eventually took you off the drug, I assume.
Oh, they took me off the drug immediately because I was like talking to things that weren't even there.
Wow.
I was like hearing music that was really beautiful, but no one else could hear it.
Right. Everything okay now?
Yeah, everything's okay now. But they ended up putting me on those, when I was in the hospital, they ended up switching me to like an antipsychotic.
Right.
Risperidone.
Yeah, Risperidone is, I think, the most prescribed drug in America right now, which is pretty bizarre.
Yeah. I was on Risperidone, and then I was on No. First, they shot me with Haloperidol because I was really psychotic when I went in there.
Right.
And a few days later, I think they started me on like Risperidone or something like that.
Right.
And I was on that medication for like 5 years.
Wow.
and I started developing breast milk. And at the time, like, I was in university and, you know, being a young female going around and sitting in classes, you know, having breast milk isn't exactly convenient.
No.
So they took me off of that, and I ended up just not taking any more antipsychotics or any type of medication after that. I just quit going to see psychiatrists.
Yeah. I hear that story a lot. So I'm glad, Julia, thank you for sharing your story with us, and I'm glad to hear that all's well with you. Thank you so much, and for watching us on YouTube too, also. Patrick in Los Angeles, you wanted to talk about the Iran-Contra hearings.
Yeah, hey, Tom. Nice to talk to you. Summer of 1987, I got sick. I was sick pretty much the entire summer long. And as a result, I just was laying around sleeping, reading, that kind of thing, watching TV. I watched almost entirely all of the Iran-Contra hearings.
Where Ollie North was up there raising his hand saying, I'm a noble patriot, you know.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. So, you know, before that, I was a Republican. And then literally the first day, it was very solidly in favor of the Republicans. The second day and beyond, I mean, their arguments got turned into garbage. I mean, you could tell, I could tell, and I was very, you know, I was very suspicious of the Democrats at the time. I was they were simply taking apart Oliver North and pretty much everything he and the other people, had to say about it. And the thing is that what they really tried to do was to focus it on, you know, Central America, the dollars getting pushed over there. And I realized slowly as these hearings went along, that was part of it, but the real big part of it was the fact that it was a quid pro quo for the Iranians, and the Iranians did something for us in order for us to sell them arms.
Yeah, and what was really bizarre about those hearings was that the authorizing legislation for the hearings said that there could be no investigation into events prior to 1981. Which means that the negotiations between Bush and Casey and the representatives of the Ayatollah in 1980 could not be discussed before Congress. So the true October surprise, the Barbara Honegger chronicles so well in her book October Surprise, that could not be discussed.
You know, that part I didn't realize, but it's funny though, because I do remember a couple instances where, you know, some things coming up, and it kind of pointed in that direction, but they didn't really continue the discussion on it.
Right.
But I mean, to be honest with you, at the end of it, I guess William Casey was supposed to speak at the end, and then he never appeared. And I didn't know why. I kind of lost track of everything, and I realized a few years later that, you know, the guy was incapacitated and, eventually died and something like that. And it happened right after, or right around the time that he was supposed to.
Let me read from Barbara's book. William Casey, dead, CIA director, reportedly attended meetings in Paris, France, with Iranian officials. The morning of his first scheduled under oath testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee on the Secret of Iran Initiative, he was struck by seizures in his CIA headquarters office in Langley, Virginia, and underwent speech incapacitating left brain surgery shortly thereafter. Had he lived to testify, according to lifelong friend and lawyer Milton Gould, Casey would have told the entire truth. He died on May 6, 87. Patrick, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Yeah, Bill Casey was going to tell the story, and he is no more, which raises the question, where's Jeff Gannon? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Diana in Portland, Maine. Hey, Diana. You wanted to talk about antidepressants?
Hey, Tom, you keep calling me from Portland, Maine. I'm from Poland.
Oh, Poland, Maine. You're
Poland,
right.
Poland, Maine.
That's what it says here, in fact. I just glanced over and you know how you... Anyway.
Home of the famous Poland spring water.
Oh, yeah. Okay, cool.
Yeah, I've been taking antidepressants probably for 24 years. And for the last 2 or 3 years, I've been trying to taper myself off of them. And I have to do it in some light active. And it's very dark here in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
I recently looked up online. I'm taking the generic Lexapro now.
Right.
And I was prescribed Lexapro after Prozac stopped working very well.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm finding out that what healthcare practitioners don't know is that Lexapro, which is a derivative of a drug called Celexa, whose patent was running out. They tweaked it a little bit, put Lexapro, repatented it. It's twice the strength of Prozac.
Wow.
And most general practitioners don't know that, I can see. And it's very difficult to transition off. You have to go down by percentages, like take 1% less of the previous dose every day. And the drug companies don't make that easy.
Right. And even at that, it would take you over 2 years to completely be off the drug.
Yeah. Yeah, which would be the safe way to do it.
Right.
So now I can see what I've been doing wrong all these years.
Right. That's remarkable. That's remarkable. Diana, thank you for calling and sharing your story. Liz in West Hollywood, California, watching Free Speech TV on the website. Hey, Liz, you have ginger. Hi. Works better than prescription drugs?
Well, I really don't want to get into prescription drugs. I used to work in a courtroom, and we had a lady in there that was addicted to Vicodin, and I thought, I don't even want to start with that stuff. Mm-hmm. And usually I could manage it with a little bit of naproxen, which is over-the-counter, and but it was getting worse and worse. And a friend of mine knew about it, and he was seeing another chiropractor who sold him some turmeric and ginger tablets.
Yeah.
And when I ran out, I went to my chiropractor, and I asked him for some, and he says, oh, I don't sell it because you can't get it as cheap as you can get it in the supermarket.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, what?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, yeah, just take some ginger and you can make a tea out of it or you can cook with it.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not big on ginger because I like sushi, but I don't like that ginger that they have. So
mm-hmm.
I thought, well, I'll try it this way. And I found, and I've come up with a system that I just wash the root off really good and then I just grate it because as I grate it, the skin comes off and it doesn't go through the grater, just the meat, mm-hmm. you know, the inside of the root. And I make a light tea and I drink that every morning and it helps. It cut my pain in half. Literally.
Wow. A lot of people swear by ginger, usually as a stomach, you know, aid. And I take curcumin every day, actually, which is the turmeric, you know. So I think they're good things. I love ginger tea. I love ginger. Liz, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for sharing that story. Hopefully there's somebody else who gets some value from it. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the end. Tom Harmon here with you, and Wayne, Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Wayne.
Hi, Tom.
Hey.
I spent the first part of my career in the 60s working in a state mental hospital without meds. It was before any antidepressants, not even lithium for bipolar illness had come out then.
Mm.
And there were people that spent their entire lives in the hospital because they were unable to function outside. And many of these people with antidepressants have become functional people over the last 60 years or so that I've been involved in it.
Mm-hmm.
I also worked in the 90s as a clinical supervisor of a treatment program for the criminally insane here in Oregon, in Eugene.
Mm-hmm.
And those people almost invariably were in the state hospital because their illness went bad when they stopped taking their meds.
Right.
And, you know, there's people that say, oh, well, that's just withdrawal from the meds. And I say that's bull because I've seen them hospitalized for their entire lives because they didn't have meds.
Right.
I worked in that period. So, you know, the fact that they're overused and overprescribed, you know, by the drug companies is an absolute fact.
Mm-hmm.
But if, you know, the tone I heard today is, oh, everybody get off your meds. And
no, that can be a big mistake.
Others.
You know, I feel the same way about the ADHD drugs. And the other thing I'm seeing, is the number, a startling number of kids who are autistic or have Asperger's who are being put on Risperidone, which is an antipsychotic, you know, just kind of dumbs them down. And you know, that. But yeah, I hope that the message has not come across from me that these things are always bad. I agree with you that there are people who are, you know, tremendously helped by, you know, better living through chemistry. On the other hand, there's a lot of people who are harmed by it, and we just need to be more conscious of this. And frankly, I think that the advent of medical marijuana is going to revolutionize the whole business.
Well, that might be. And the other thing is, I'm really leery of GPs prescribing these meds. I think that, you know, it's
should be psychiatrists.
Cardiac drugs. You don't. Yeah. Bipolar illness and depression, before they had meds, had a 40% mortality rate.
Wow.
So you talk about these people killing themselves and such when they get off their meds. Yeah, but they were killing themselves before we had the meds, too.
Right. Okay. Wayne, thank you for sharing your experience and expertise with us. I appreciate it. Jim in Sullivan, Illinois. Hey, Jim. Antidepressants?
Yeah, I was reading a book, right? In fact, I'm reading it now. It's by Jim Mars, The $1 Trillion Conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about psychiatry. A lot of people don't realize a lot of the stuff that they prescribe and that was invented by the Nazis. After Operation Paperclip, a lot of the stuff that came out with psychiatry was brought over by Nazi Germany with Operation Paperclip. You wouldn't believe all these. You know, everybody thinks that they just went to NASA and the CIA, but they went to public health, advertising. They went all over in our society.
Right.
And
but that doesn't necessarily mean it's bad.
Well, some of the stuff that he did, well, fluoridated water isn't a very good thing. That was brought over from the Nazis and that, you know, that was.
Well, there's still an argument about that. I mean, it's.
Well, back in the 50s, according to Jim Mars, you know, there was 79 Nobel Prize winners of medicine, physiology.
Oh, there are a lot of scientists who are opposed to fluoridation of water. You know, I give you that. And there's a lot who are saying, you know, hey, it cuts cavities. And I don't think that's much in dispute. But really, do we want to medicate an entire population to deal with, you know, tooth decay?
That wasn't true with the teeth and that. In fact, you know, one of the side effects of this, you know, the fastest growing disease now is Alzheimer's, and that was the byproduct of sodium fluoride in our medicines like Prozac and that. Yeah. They have all this stuff in there. And another thing, he talks about these prescription drugs, you know, like something like Xanax. It costs two and a quarter cents to make per thousand for the active ingredients, and they want they charge $136 for 100. Their markup is 600,000%.
Yeah, the markup is mind-boggling in that industry. Jim, thanks for the call. It's funny because I've read Jim Mars's stuff in the past, and I don't know. I'll leave it at that. Connie in Canton, Illinois. Hey, Connie, you wanted to give us a heads up on another book like Honegger's
book. Hi, Tom. Well, Barbara didn't get a chance to mention that there were other authors that followed her. And, you know, and to my mind, they stole her title, October Surprise.
Yeah, Gary Sick had a book out by that title, didn't he?
Yeah, he came out. And he, you know, I'm not saying these other authors were plagiarists. However, they borrowed heavily from Barbara's original work.
Right.
And so I just want to caution interested parties that if they're looking for Barbara's October Surprise, and let's say they find the title, right, at a used or old bookstore or used books or something, that they need to make sure it's Barbara Honegger.
Right.
I think the copyright on that was 1989.
Yeah.
But,
and it was published, I'm holding it in my hands here for people who are watching. It was published by Tudor Publishing Company, which went out of business, as I recall, shortly after they published this book. And it was published in April of 1989.
What a coincidence.
Yeah. I think, you know, the question was, you know, did the CIA buy it up, or the Bush administration, you know, the Bush family, did somebody buy the publishing company? Who knows? I don't
really
know. Yeah. There was speculation back then. I haven't discussed it with Barbara, so I don't know what the real story is. But I was, you know, sincere. If she owns the rights to her book, which she may not. I don't know. I'd have to look at the copyright notice. But if she owns the rights to her books, I would love to help her get it back into print.
so I'll definitely be inquiring about that.
Yeah, but there's used copies floating around. It's October Surprise by Barbara Honegger. The subtitle is, Did the Reagan-Bush Election Campaign Sabotage President Carter's Attempts to Free the American Hostages in Iran? And, of course, the answer that she puts in excruciating detail is yes. Connie, thanks a lot for the call, and great to hear from you. We'll be back. In fact, we're going to be back with Brian Fisher. Oh, this should be entertaining. The American Family Association. Is the Christian right responsible for the decline of religion? You think?
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And some very interesting statistics here. This from a piece by C.J. Worldman in the in alternate.org, published on March 22nd of this year. C.J. says, of those aged 18 to 35, 3 out of 10, 30%, say they are not affiliated with any religion at all, while only half are absolutely certain a God exists. This is the highest level of religious disaffiliation for any generation in the past quarter century. The argument that I think C.J. Worldman is making is that religion evolved as an attempt to make sense of a world that people didn't understand. Why is that lightning strike coming out of the sky? Oh, it must be because Thor is banging his hammer up there. And then later it became, okay, you know, Thor doesn't make so much sense, so maybe it's God is angry. And then, you know, that didn't make sense. So it's, but we still, you know, you find the reporter sticking the microphone in somebody's face after the hurricane came through and took out their neighbor's trailer park. And, oh, you know, I'm so glad God saved me. Well, what about your neighbor? Your neighbor's dead. Well, you know, let's not talk about that. So anyhow, it seems that as people are more and more relying on science, number one, they are relying less and less on a religion. And number two, that religion, and we certainly saw this during the Middle Ages, when the Catholic Church took over most of Europe, that, and we see this in other parts of the world as well, with the Taliban, for example, in Afghanistan and Pakistan, that religion becomes an instrument of control. And people push back on control and say, no, thank you, I'm not going to do that just because you said so, because you said God told you to. And so these two factors, people pushing back and the right-wing fundamentalists in the United States even reaching out to take control of a political party, and the affiliation between the Republican Party and the right-wing Christians has turned off a lot of people just to the idea of religion, which I think is frankly kind of sad. I think that religion has a lot to offer people. But anyhow, that's on the table. And so I wanted to ask Brian Fisher his thoughts on this. He's the host of Focal Point Radio on AFR Talk. He's the director of issues analysis for government and public policy at the American Family Association, a essentially fundamentally Christian organization. Do I have all that right, Brian?
Well, you know, I'm looking at this piece by C.J. Worldman. This must be enormously discouraging to atheists, because after 100 years of brainwashing, they've only convinced 30% of young Americans not to affiliate with a Christian denomination. That must be terribly discouraging for them.
But it's the trend. It is the trend. The trend is people disaffiliating with religions. And
self-identifying as agnostics or atheists.
Well, of course, the problem is 18 to 35-year-old people are not going to remain 18 to 35 forever. They're going to grow up and develop a mature hunger for God.
How do you know that?
Because it happens all the time. I saw it when I was a pastor. I can't tell you how many people, Tom, came to faith when they became parents, and all of a sudden they got serious about life and about God, wound up in my church. Happens all the time.
So this is sort of like what Winston Churchill said about conservatives, that you're liberal when you're young, and when you get older and wealthier, you become conservative.
Yeah, something like that. People grow up, and they mature, and they outgrow some of their childish ideas about life and about God. For instance, that religion evolved. Well, certain religions may have evolved, but Christianity didn't evolve. It is a revealed religion. God himself revealed the essence of Christianity.
But there was a, you know, there was a fundamental schism between the Pauline church and the Jesus church in the first 100 years. The, you know, Jesus' disciples, that church did not survive.
No,
Paul
actually
was not among them. Paul,
no,
you know.
There was no schism whatsoever. In fact, Paul made it very clear that the gospel that he preached was the gospel that he received from Jesus himself. There's no schism.
Who he never met physically on this earth.
Oh, yes, he did. He said, the gospel I preached, I received through a revelation of Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ himself manifested himself to me and taught me the gospel.
Somebody saying, you know, God talked to me.
Well, it makes it a revealed religion, not an evolved religion.
Okay. What are evolved religions?
Well, you could look at Islam.
They depend on the same scripture as Christianity by and large.
No, they depend on the Quran. They do not depend
on
the Bible.
Well, they also cite the Old Testament and the New Testament.
Yeah, but they don't believe that Jesus was God. There's a fundamental difference between
Islam and
Christianity.
They believe he was one of the prophets.
No, but they don't believe he was God. In fact, they'll stone you to death if you say that Jesus was God in a Muslim country. That's a big difference there between the two faiths.
Because this was revealed to Muhammad, right?
Well, yeah, that's what he claimed.
Islam is a revealed religion as well.
Well, that's what they claim. That means somebody's right and somebody's wrong. Either the Muslims are right and we're wrong, or we are right and the Muslims are wrong.
What if everybody's wrong? What if there is no, you know, Bronze Age thunder god who kills people when he gets upset with them?
Well, I guess if
and
everybody's
is going to torture you for the rest of your life if you don't do what he says.
I guess if everybody's wrong, Tom, then you're just as wrong as the rest of us.
Well, I'm not asserting anything. I'm asking a question. Do you feel, Brian, that you're hedging your bets or that? In fact, I shouldn't even personalize this. Do you think that many of the people who come to church on Sundays do so to hedge their bets, or do they do so because they actually get some value out of religion? And if it's the latter, and I'm guessing you're going to say it is, what is it that they get?
Well, philosopher Blaise Pascal, I think it was, or maybe it was Augustine, said that there is a God-shaped vacuum in the heart of every single human being. That means you as well as me, Tom. And people look for God. The only thing that will fill that vacuum is God, and that's why they go to church. And when they find God, that vacuum is filled. And so, yes, it's very satisfying to them.
Well, yeah, I don't disagree with that. Although, what was his name? The guy who used to, Carl Sagan. Used to talk about how, you know, what did that for him was looking through a telescope. I mean, isn't there a whole variety of ways that people can experience the, you know, what William Blake called the ecstatic experience, the religious experience?
Oh,
you know,
sure.
The piercing of the veil without a revealed religion, without, you know, somebody thousands of years ago having told somebody else that God talked to them, and now here we are 2,000 years later dancing to that tune?
Well, Jesus was very clear that no one comes to the Father except through me. So there may be other ways that people pursue the numinous or whatever you want to call it, but there's only one true way to the Father. That's through Jesus Christ.
But what if he was speaking not literally of him as a personality? What if he was saying, but by this technique or this, you know, this presence?
Well, he didn't give us that option, Tom. He said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. So somebody's got a problem with that. Their problem's not with me. Their problem's with Jesus himself, and I suggest they take it up with him.
Yeah, or whoever edited that particular biblical scripture.
Well, there's no evidence that that happened.
There's no evidence that the Bible's been edited over the years?
None.
You're not serious, Brian.
No, there are 5,280 manuscript copies of the New Testament that agree in every major particular down to the detail. So that's just a myth that somebody tampered with it or came along later and monkeyed with it. Just a myth. There's absolutely no historical foundation to that theory whatsoever.
Wow. Are you familiar with the work of Mr. Funk and Elaine Pagels and, you know, some of these, the Jesus Project, where they went through the New Testament and figured out, you know, what did Jesus actually probably say and not probably
just,
say? Have you read any of that stuff?
Oh, sure. Yeah, they just made stuff up. They have absolutely no documentary evidence for their theories whatsoever.
But there are no original versions of any of that stuff. I mean, the oldest original version of anything is a fragment of the Gospel of Mark that's from the 3rd century.
Well, if there was anything to their theory, Tom, you would expect to find somewhere in some ancient cave or whatever, some document that would verify what they say. There is none. Zero, zip, they do not exist.
Interesting. Do you think that by reaching out to control politics or participate in politics, that Christians are hurting themselves?
Absolutely not. You know, the Bible teaches us that the truth claims of God are true for all people at all times in all places. You know, and it's silly to accuse us of wanting a theocracy when all we're seeking to do is get people involved voluntarily in the political process choose leaders who reflect their values. That's not theocracy. That's democracy.
Okay. Brian Fisher. Good talking with you, Brian.
Thank you, Tom.
AFA.net, by the way, is his website.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, it's an interesting topic. We'll be back 15 minutes past it. Pretty fascinating stuff. Yeah. Alyssa. In Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Alyssa, what's up?
Oh, I was just listening to that last guest you had on, and what I found fascinating was how he claimed that people, when they become parents, will suddenly come back to their religion, because I was raised Mormon. I was very devout, and it was actually when my twin sons were 4 months old that I lost my religion.
Hmm. I should have asked Brian about Mormonism, because I have a feeling he would have been about as enthusiastic about it as he is about Islam. Although I don't want to put words in his mouth. I don't genuinely know.
But the fact of the matter is, it's very Christian-like.
Right.
So, in fact, looking at my infant sons was one of the things that gave me the strength to notify my family and move forward with my new convictions that it wasn't true.
Wow. Very impressive. Well, Alyssa, I wish you the very best in life, and thank you for sharing your story with us.
Thank you. Okay. Bye-bye.
Yep. Let's see here. Michael in Dublin, Virginia.
Hi.
Free Speech
Hi,
TV. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Yeah, all these three of these religions, the major religions, have violence associated with murders. I mean, and also, I believe they all
well,
violent.
Hang on just a second. You've got the Hindus have a pretty warlike history as well. I think Buddhism is the one religion that has never had a war declared in its name.
I'm probably wrong on that.
There's probably some obscure war someplace.
Yeah, the interesting thing about Hinduism is they talk in the
the Upanishads.
Gita or something?
The Bhagavad Gita.
Yeah, they talk about the star beings that come and are fighting ships in the sky, and you look at Christianity, you see that a lot of that is the worship of the sun. You know, of course, the sun doesn't rise; we're dead. So, of course, it's our risen Savior. You know, and then you look at some of the other Islam; it comes out of the same. It's a compilation of all of that. And then you look at the Moses. And that faith, I don't want to knock any of them, but there are astrological worships of planetary or some kind of scientific planetary basis here. The Mount Sinai, Mount Sinai, they have this mountain in Arabia that's called Ai, and the god that's called Ai, and the god that comes, the moon rises from behind that mountain, and it's called. And they called this moon, this mountain was called, the god was called Sin. So you put Sin and AI together, you have Sinai. Mm. And, you know, it's interesting. But
yeah.
They're all violent.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of Christianity and Judaism that you can trace back to far more ancient religions, and particularly our Christian rituals. You know, the Easter bunny, the Christmas tree, those are clearly pagan. They are, you know, ancient and pre-Christian. Fascinating stuff. Michael, thanks for the call. Religion is one of my favorite topics. I just find it an unending well of fascinating curiosity and all these little kind of alleyways that you can, you know, go down and find new things. Anyway, we'll be back 20 minutes past that. Welcome back. Tom in Downers Grove, Illinois. Hey, Tom, you wanted to talk about religious scholarship?
Yeah.
Hello?
Yes. Can you hear me?
I hear you just fine.
All right. Tom, I've admired you for so many years, it's not even funny. Anyway, this quick. I got involved with study of comparative religion about 25 or 30 years ago, and I guess the master was Joseph Campbell.
Oh, yeah.
And
those videotapes that he did with Bill Moyers?
Yes. Well, as you well know, up until his death in 1988, he was regarded as probably one of the top three in the world on comparative religion and mythology. He wrote 40 books.
Yeah.
He was a consultant on Star Wars and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, he was the man.
What I can't do, obviously, is you can't go back and share, 200,000 years of history that he put together. But what he does, or what he did, was presented in a way from an archaeological and historical fact. And he basically left it up to the individual. Case in point is this new blockbuster coming out, Noah.
Right.
Well, if you go back to Gilgamesh, and then Babylonian, and then you look at Pishna, which was the Babylonian Noah,
mm-hmm.
and you read that whole story, and then you discover that 10 of the tribes of Israel were held in bondage by Babylonia for about 100 years. Gee, do you think maybe their mythology came into play with the Hebrews?
Yeah, and the Epic of Gilgamesh is the oldest known written story out of Western civilization. It's 6 to 7,000 years old. It predates the Old Testament and the New Testament, and it has in it a great flood.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And there is now obviously a gross amount of geological knowledge that there was a melting of the glaciers that caused the Mediterranean to rise and the Black Sea, and which was close to Turkey, which is where all this started. Anyway, the other thing when it came to the New Testament, as the gentleman that you interviewed, if anybody looks at Zarathustra, which was about 500 to 600 years before Jesus supposedly was here, it's the exact story of Jesus.
Right, the virgin birth, the dead raised 3 days later, all that stuff.
Savior and the whole nine yards.
Yeah,
you know?
I'm familiar.
And that was with Persia. So the thing of it is, as Campbell pointed out, the Bible, the Judeo-Christian Bible, is the only religious book that it reads like a newspaper. Such and such happened on this day, and this happened on this day, and so on and so forth. And we now know, with all the historical and archaeological facts that we found, that no, it really didn't do that way. So anyway, I'm not going to take any more of your time, but there are so much research and facts out there. JCF.org is the a website for Campbell, if anybody's interested.
Oh, the Joseph Campbell Foundation. Great. Tom, thanks for sharing that. I appreciate it. Thanks for the call. Robert, in Clamato, New Mexico. Am I saying it right, Robert?
Yes, sir. It's Clamato.
Great. So you wanted to talk about why young people are not being drawn to religion?
Yeah, I have a daughter just turned 16 years, and I have pondered this personally for a long time. And the biggest thing that comes to mind that's pretty obvious, when they say that, you know, going into politics and all that, when they try to pass laws that are generally hateful, for instance, the whole recently against homosexual marriage.
Sure.
And trying to pass laws. I mean, if you listen to the words of Jesus, it was, you know, if you're without sin, you're throw the first stone.
Right. He was kind of the original hippie.
Yeah, that was my opinion. And when people aren't, young people aren't stupid, and when they see this carrying on and trying to get into other people's lives and force them to do or change or live by their own ideals or thoughts, I mean, that's what's driving them away.
Yeah. You know, what has come to my mind many times is that the more evangelical somebody is, the more uncertain they are. And that's why they're out trying to convince other people, is every time they can convince somebody, it causes them to feel a little more certainty. And uncertainty is something that none of us do well with. So, you know, it's very interesting. Robert, thanks for the call. From Robert to Robert. Oop, the second Robert, I just dumped you by accident. My apologies. Terry in Elgin, Illinois. You want to talk about the apocryphal gospel?
I'm happy to talk to you, Hal. Good morning. Good afternoon. Hey, I was going to talk about the apocryphal gospel because I think they omitted part of that.
Yeah, there are books in the Catholic Bible that aren't in the Protestant Bible, and there are books that didn't make it into either one of them.
Well, that's editing, isn't it?
Right. Yeah, that is editing. Yeah.
Well, your previous caller said that the Bible wasn't, there's no evidence of editing the Bible.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, at some point, somebody had to say, okay, this is the Bible. And apparently that point was around the 7th century, you know, the Second Council of Constantinople in 666 or thereabouts, or 633, or I forget the year, but probably wasn't 666. That would cause a lot of people to be spooked. But it was,
all right, Tom, it was nice talking to you.
Thanks a lot, Terry. Good to hear from you. It was around the 7th century in any case. So we will continue this conversation on the other side. The question that I'm asking, that I'm wondering, is the decline in religious participation in America, particularly with regard to Christianity, the direct result of the Christian right, starting largely during the Reagan administration, the Christian right reaching out and trying to take control of our government? I think that turns people off. I think it's harming Christianity.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And by the way, I think it's harming our political system and our nation as well. 28 minutes past. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. You know, big data is big money. And pretty much everything you do online these days is tracked, cataloged, and sold by big corporations looking to make a buck on your information. Case in point, PayPal. On Sunday, that company, which prides itself on giving people a secure way to buy things online, sent all its customers an email pointing out their new privacy policies. Wolf Richter over at Naked Capitalism has done us all a favor, read those policies, and found that PayPal can send you tons of your personal information, including financial data, web preferences, and even your physical location, to a bunch of places you might not want it to go. The places PayPal sends your personal information to include eBay and its affiliates. They, of course, own PayPal. Service providers under contract who help with PayPal's business operations. Financial institutions that PayPal partners with. Credit bureaus, collection agencies, banking partners. Companies that PayPal plans to merge with or are acquired by. And law enforcement, government officials, or other third parties pursuant to a subpoena. So your data isn't really yours after all. Of course, PayPal isn't the only company taking your personal information. Google, Amazon, all the big websites, they all do it. And they're not always sneaky about it either. Google's actually publicly asked the Supreme Court to legalize its practice of using Street View mapping cars to steal data from unencrypted Wi-Fi networks. Now, some people don't worry about the kind of corporate snooping done by companies like Google and PayPal. After all, it's not like Google and PayPal can kill you.
But our government actually does have the power of guns and jail cells, and more they're ending up with this data. At the same time, as private contractors increasingly take on the role of the government, the line between supposedly safe corporate spying and dangerous government spying starts to blur. 70%, by some estimates, of the NSA's budget goes to private contractors like Booz Allen Hamilton, once owned in part by the Carlyle Group, once owned in part by the Bin Laden family, and the former employer of Edward Snowden. Amazon, meanwhile, recently cut a multi-million dollar cloud computing contract with the CIA, and the CEO now owns the Washington Post. And thanks to Edward Snowden, we know that Microsoft helped the NSA find a backdoor into its Outlook email program so that that intelligence agency could snoop on Outlook users' web chats. So what happens when governments and corporations become one? Benito Mussolini invented a word for that. He called it fascism. And now we have billionaires like the Koch brothers whining on the op-ed pages of our nation's newspapers that their attempts to get corporate-friendly Republicans elected are being unfairly attacked. In reality, democracy itself is now under attack. The idea that turning a nation's economy over to a free market and their corporatists, the idea that that is idiotic is not a new idea. Thomas Jefferson laid it out in an 1816 letter to Samuel Kercheval. Those seeking profits, Jefferson wrote, were they given total freedom, would not be the ones to trust to keep government pure and our rights secure. Indeed, it has always been those seeking wealth who were the source of corruption in government. No other depositories of power have ever yet been found which did not end in converting to their own profit the earnings of those committed to their charge. He added, I am not among those who fear the people. They, and not the rich, are our dependents for continued freedom. We must make an election between economy and liberty, or profusion and servitude. Otherwise, as the people of England are, our people, like them, must come to labor 16 hours in the 24. And in the 16th, being insufficient to afford us bread, we must live as they do now on oatmeal and potatoes. Have no time to think, no means of calling them as managers to account, but be glad to obtain subsistence by hiring ourselves to rivet their chains on the necks of our fellow sufferers. End of quote from Thomas Jefferson. This totally free market where corporations reign supreme, just like the oppressive governments of old, Jefferson said could transform America, quote, until the bulk of the society is reduced to be mere automatons of misery, to have no sensibilities left but for sinning and suffering, then begins indeed the bella omnium in omnia. This is the war of all against all, which some philosophers, observing to be so general in this world, have mistaken for the natural instead of the abusive state of man. Progressive taxation also has a long history. Jefferson wrote in a 1785 letter to James Madison, quote, another means of silently lessening the inequality of property is to exempt all from taxation below a certain point and to tax the higher portions of property in geometrical progression as they rise. It's time for us to use that tool and roll back the wealth and power of these billionaires. And while we're at it, stop this whole corporate state business that Mussolini identified back in the 30s. And while we're at that, we could stop the religion and state business that Jerry Falwell was promoting so aggressively. Oh, really? I mean, you know, this was another thing that Jefferson was pushing back against in the 1770s. What was going on in Massachusetts? So, anyhow, end of rant. Dave in Batavia, Illinois. You wanted to talk about the historical Jesus? Thanks for listening to CPT, by the way.
I did. Great Jefferson quote, by the way. The Jesus seminar with Crisson and Funk set preconditions on examining the text, a little bit like the Jefferson Bible in a way, in that they said that they would not consider as authentic any scripture that talked about miracles. Mm-hmm. They converted Jesus into a wandering sage and, you know, said nice things about his positive statements about the possibilities of a good life, that sort of thing.
Well, wait a minute, Dave. I read this stuff, and my recollection is not that they said we're not going to talk about Jesus' miracles, but that Jesus didn't talk about his miracles.
Well, they...
And their goal was to figure out which of the words attributed to Jesus were actually words that Jesus probably said or most likely didn't say. Right. They had, they printed it in four different colors,
they had
right?
colored dots.
Black, gray, they red, and colored, bright red. Or pink and red.
Exactly. And they put a dot next to each verse
based on the probability that Jesus might have really said that.
Right.
And the red dots that got crossed out were dots that had to do with miracles, by and large. I mean, you can go back and check that.
Yeah, I think you should, because I don't recall Jesus ever referring to his own miracles. The miracle stories were told by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Jesus, you know, blessed the fishes and the loaves, and suddenly there's 5,000 fishes and all these loaves.
You're doing a Jeffersonian thing, which usually is a good thing, although maybe not in this case, which is to you've culled out everything except the red verses, you know.
Well, no, they were just looking at the words that were attributed to him. I mean, there's a whole other side debate, Dave, about whether this particular historical figure even existed or whether it was an amalgamation of a bunch of people, you know, as well. Although I think the predicating assumption for all these guys in the Jesus seminar
rhetorically,
that he
existed. Words spoken by Jesus or words spoken about Jesus are all from, as you said earlier in your earlier conversation, are written by people who were, we assume, historical writers, you know.
None of this got written down until 100 years after he was dead.
To call out all that information and say, we're not going to look at that, is fallacious, you know,
okay,
what you're doing there.
Okay. All right. Dave, I will not challenge that. Thank you for the call. Judy in Oakdale, Connecticut, you have a theory on why young people are not interested in the church? Judy?
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I was just wanted to say one of the main reasons that young kids are not coming into the church, besides the reasons that you stated, is that the church isn't operating the way it's supposed to be. We're supposed to be operating in the supernatural because that's what's in the Gospels.
Right.
And so you only have a small segment of the church even attempting to do that.
Mm-hmm.
It's really the Western church that doesn't really understand what's going on. But there's a small group of us that are wanting to move to that. That's, you know, you see the rise of the occult going on with youth, you know, a lot of witchcraft and all that stuff. And it's because there's a longing for that kind of thing, for miracles and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. I think there is. I think the ability and the need to experience the transcendent is wired into us.
It absolutely is wired into us. I mean, God is spirit.
Yeah. The question is how do you get there? How do you do that? Judy, thank you for the.
It is a practice, and I just want to say this one thing that
sure.
You can say all your interpretations of the Bible, whatever. But if you really want to know the truth, you have to experience Jesus Christ in a supernatural way. Many of us have. Many of us see him and all these kind of miracles that are going on, and we want more of that. And that's the only thing that's really going to turn this country around.
So you just moved from having personal supernatural experience to politics. Do you really want to connect the two?
I don't know. I mean,
what if somebody says they've never had a personal supernatural experience? Should they not be part of governance?
Should they not be part of government?
Right.
Well, I mean, if you've got people operating in that and know what they're doing and all that stuff, I can tell you I don't like what's going on in the church. I just left the church after the last election because I received so much criticism for voting for Obama.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, and I really, probably a year before the second election of Obama, I found Free Speech TV.
Yeah. See, this was my point to Brian Fisher, is I didn't want to, you know, just throw it in his face, but that folks, these fundamentalist right-wingers who are trying to take over not just churches and not just souls, but the political processes of the United States are harming themselves because they're causing people to turn away from a religion that might otherwise be of value to them. Judy, thank you for the call. Good hearing from you. Thank you. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
This is also the essential argument that C.J. Whirlman is making in his piece on alt. I assume it's he. Could be a she. Christian right has major role in hastening the decline of religion in America. Welcome back. And John, listening on WBAI in Uniondale, New York. Hey, John, what's up?
How you doing, Tom? Great show.
Thank you.
I was at a church, a Christian Cultural Center, this weekend in Brooklyn, and the pastor specifically was speaking about Jesus and his call to people to serve others, and he mentioned politics. And he basically said, of course, that, you know, we the people, we elect officials to serve us. And that's what's not happening. But then again, Jesus, when Jesus came, he washed the feet of his disciples, and they were shocked.
Right.
Such a great prophet would bow down and wash the feet of his follower. And his example to the people is what we're supposed to be following. And I just want to make one more comment. The gentleman mentioned Muslims, and, you know, the world knows that the Muslims, they speak of the Bible text, and in the Quran, it's built and based on Bible text also, but revealed by the angel Gabriel that's in the Christian Bible.
Right.
And, you know, the man wants to acknowledge that, you know, Christianity was revealed. And then when Muhammad's form of Christianity is revealed to his people in his language, he finds something wrong with it. And instead of trying to figure out how to agree on 99.9% of the word as it relates to the Christians, the Jews, and the
Muslims.
You know, they take the time to fight, which causes confusion among all the followers. Like, why are they fighting if they're so godly?
Yeah.
Why are they fighting? You know? And you know, so, you know, I specifically, when I speak to Jewish people, when I speak to Muslims, and when I speak to Christians, first I have to understand their culture, not their color, you know, their culture. Mm. And then speak to them as it relates to their culture, because Jesus spoke to everybody. So it should be kind of easy to speak their language as it relates to anything written in any of the books. And, you know, and people that are studied have a problem reaching out to anybody that just doesn't agree with them outright.
Yeah, I think that's part of the human condition in a way.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Okay, John, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. And thanks for listening to WBAI. Anton in Spokane, Washington. Hey, Anton, what's up?
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah. I just like to say, you're talking about religion. Religion is in itself, if people would apply the principles in what's in the Bible, we wouldn't be the situation that we're in today.
Mm-hmm.
That what other people that have the control use religion to control people with. And we're talking about the government and
right.
the religion being separate. It doesn't matter how anyone looks at it. Anyone born in this country is a part of the government. We all are a part of the system.
Yeah.
Whether we deny it or we can justify our reasons why we aren't, but the bottom line is we all are, because it affects all of us.
Yeah, and this is one of the reasons why it's so important that we actually get active. I mean, if you're horrified by the death penalty, for example, let's do something about it, and or whatever it may be, drone wars, I mean, fill in the blanks. Anton, thank you very much for the call. It's 10 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back. Occupying the media and defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you, and Steve in Chicago. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Yes, I wanted to interject my position with regard to this question of why we think young people are to a lesser degree interested in religion. And I think to some extent it can be explained in terms of applying the same sort of axiom that King applied when he talked about the arc of justice, being long with bending bending. I'm trying to do two different things over here at the same time, just on the computer. But in any case, with regard to science also falling under that heading, that it may be long, but that arc bends towards reason and rationality and logic. And that it tends to explain away why it is that, you know, young people who don't find much rationality, for instance, in this Noah story. I mean, you know, let's be serious. You know, there's 1,001 ways that that's just you know, an irrational story that couldn't possibly have taken place. So instead, they substitute spiritualism. I think, you know, a lot of people say, yes, I believe now that there's some higher power, but it's not this because, quite frankly, you know, I can't believe this sort of mythology. And this is the same sort of thing that some authors have suggested explains ufology, for instance. You know, yeah. That many people who firmly believe that we are being visited, you know, by persons, by beings or persons from another planet, believe it, and it turns out that, you know, angels have now been substituted for by aliens. So right. Now the things that we believed 1,000 years ago, angels and supernatural beings, you know, under the auspices of religion did, now aliens from other planets or universes are doing, you know. So, you know, and a lot of, again, it's this need to believe in something greater than ourselves. And if it can't be religion, because that's been discredited in many ways using science, then we turn to science and we think, oh, wow, it's the Star Trek version of, you know, there's something bigger out there.
I think there's a middle ground. And that is to say, within the context of religion, there are two things happening. One is an attempt to achieve transcendence. And you find that, you know, sprinkled through maybe 30-40% of religious texts, whether it's the Upanishads or the Christian Bible. And the other is an attempt to explain the history of the tribe, to say this is who we are and where we came from. And, for example, in the book of Genesis, there are actually two creation stories in the first two chapters of Genesis. And they're slightly different. But, you know, one of them in the primary Genesis creation story, you got Adam and Eve, right? God made Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve have a couple of sons. Cain and Abel. Thank you, Jim. It's been too many years since I taught Sunday school, right? Cain and Abel. Cain kills Abel. Abel was the pastoralist. Cain was the farmer. God was unhappy with Cain's farming. And so Cain kills Abel. And then Cain gets banished and goes off to the next town over and finds a wife. And which raises the question, next town over? I thought, you know, Adam and Eve were the very first people. No, they were the very first people of that tribe. This is a creation story of a tribe. So it's entirely possible that particular tribe might have been just 500 people wandering around and or living in some part of the world where they had some torrential downpour one year and it wiped out, you know, like the mile wide hurricane coming across Oklahoma. It wiped out so many people that the guy who had the boat ended up surviving, and he brought his dog and his cat and his goats and chickens with him. And over time, that story became the story of Noah. I mean,
and I wish that the guest that you had on had an opportunity to address this whole question of why do we have two different gods in the Old and New Testament? The Old Testament God is a sociopathic murderer, and then in the New Testament we get something completely different, and which also includes, by the way, the Book of Revelations, which in today's world, you know, if some guy emerged from a cave, you know, almost a century after the death of Jesus, saying, you know, I've got this other book we need to add on to the Bible, and it includes, you know, stories about how the world is going to end, we would have that person committed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The Book of Revelation is pretty complex. Steve, thanks for the call. It's a lot to think about. It's a lot to think about. David, in Rockford, Illinois, you wanted to get back to SSRIs?
Hi, Tom. I'm the first-time caller.
Well, thank you. Just for people who are just tuning in, we started our show 2.5 hours ago with Dr. Peter Bregan talking about how both the New York Times and the Washington Post are reporting that the Fort Hood gunman, was on antidepressants, and his suggesting that leads people to be more likely to commit suicide and to go out in a blaze of glory, as this guy did, by taking other people with them. Back to you.
I just wanted to share my experience as a healthcare provider and as a patient. I started my very first panic attack was in 1989, and then that was the time I was finishing my undergrad, so I went to University of Iowa, and I was told, oh, there is a miracle, a drug, which later on I found out it's a tricyclic antidepressant, and I was on it. And I tell you, the side effects are much worse than the symptoms you have from whatever you are suffering, depression or panic attack. And later on, I started taking a serotonin reuptake inhibitor, and I've been on it for almost 20 years.
Yeah.
And I can tell you, I would not be a productive member of this society if I could not, if I wasn't on this medication.
Yeah. Well, I've heard that story many times now today.
The other thing is, these drugs, they have come a long way. I remember the time they were using group of drugs called MAO inhibitor.
Right.
That you could have stroke if you had a certain cheese or red wine.
Right.
And now these are much safer, but overall we have to be smart consumers and do our research.
Right. And have an appropriate physician who sees you frequently enough that they actually know what's going on. David, thank you for the call. And thanks for listening to WCPT. Coming up tomorrow, it's Friday. That means it's Brunch with Bernie, America's Senator. Senator Bernie Sanders will be here talking about all the important issues of the week and taking your calls. So in our national town hall meeting. Plus, anything goes Friday. What's on your mind? And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It actually does begin with you. So get out there, get active, and occupy something. Tag your name. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.